You're listening to the Kurdistan in America podcast, the official podcast of the Kurdistan Regional Government Representation in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Dilovan Barwari. This episode features an interview with Kathy Carey, the U.S. Strategic Partnerships Advisor for the Mines Advisory Group, known as MAG. MAG is an advocacy organization that finds, removes, and destroys landmines, cluster munitions, and unexploded bombs from places affected by conflict. The organization has worked in the Kurdistan region of Iraq since 1992, and the discussion is centered around their activities in the Kurdistan region and Sinjar district. But before the interview, here's the latest news update on the Kurdistan region. As usual, we'll begin with the KRG-Baghdad relations. On November 12th, the Iraqi parliament passed a controversial budget deficit law. However, the Kurdish bloc in the Iraqi parliament boycotted the session over disagreements about a clause the Kurdish lawmaker described as unjust for the people of Kurdistan region. Now, the deficit law allows the Iraqi government to borrow $10 billion to cover government expenses for the last quarter of 2020. But the issue is that the law requires the KRG to submit all of its oil and non-oil revenues in order to get its partial share, which is actually less than the $780 million the KRG needs to function on a monthly basis. Several Kurdish leaders viewed the budget law as a direct attack against the people of Kurdistan. Also, on November 14th, Prime Minister Masroor Barzani responded to the controversial budget vote via Twitter and stated, quote, "Kurdistan's share of federal revenues isn't a privilege. It's a right. And I've said in the past, the relationship between Erbil and Baghdad should be based on recognizing each other's rights and duties under the Constitution. This dangerous precedent must quickly be reversed. We have an opening still to correct this injustice." Unquote. At the core of the problem is that the budget deficit law contradicted the August understanding between Baghdad and KRG. The agreement was that the federal government would send $270 million monthly payments to the Kurdistan region as a partial share of the budget. In return, Erbil will continue the ongoing negotiations with Baghdad over oil exports and customs revenues. Of course, the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kadhimi has a different take on this. He wants to resolve the disputes between Baghdad and Erbil according to the Iraqi constitution. After a cabinet meeting, the Iraqi Prime Minister's office released a statement on November 24th, where Mr. Kadhimi stated, "We have problems with the fiscal deficit law. The law involves problems and errors." He also met with Bashir Haddad, the deputy speaker of the Iraqi parliament, who is from the Kurdistan region, to discuss the federal budget, promising to deliver October salaries for Kurdistan region's civil servants. Nevertheless, the KRG's official statement read as follows, quote, "The Kurdistan regional government has consistently expressed its readiness to find a peaceful and fair solution to outstanding issues within the framework of the Constitution of Iraq," unquote. And on November 25th, the KRG cabinet decided to send a formal request to its Iraqi counterpart, asking for its monthly share, which has yet to be released. Additionally, Jude Yar Adil, the spokesperson for the KRG, stated if Baghdad doesn't send the KRG share of the budget, the KRG would have other options and alternatives, but it will wait for Baghdad's response first. I will now pivot to the recent developments in the Kurdistan region. The United States delivered a new batch of military equipment to the Kurdistan region on November 10th as part of efforts to strengthen Peshmerga forces, combat terrorism, and back reform in the Ministry of Peshmerga Affairs. The aid included 150 Humvees, transport vehicles, and various weaponry to be distributed to the 14th and 16th Peshmerga Brigades. Brigadier General Tykert, the senior defense official that handed over the delivery at a ceremony in Erbil, stated, "The military equipment provided is a clear sign of the long-term and deep relationship between the Kurdistan Regional Government and the United States." It's worth mentioning that this is the second delivery of such kind this year. Another major development pertains to KRG's reform agenda. As I have mentioned in previous episodes, the KRG has taken several major steps to fight corruption and reform the economy. On November 25th, the KRG took another significant step in that direction. It signed a contract with Mollaber Group of Germany to digitize key public services. The project will see driver's license and vehicle registration digital services in the next 12 months, benefiting almost 2 million citizens. It will end dependence on paperwork and provide mobile police with technology necessary to instantly identify drivers and vehicles. Let's pivot to the security and humanitarian side. The Iraqi government has decided to close down IDP camps in areas outside the Kurdistan region, sending displaced Iraqis to their homes. The decision has been criticized by aid groups, fearing it would further expose the already vulnerable population to the upcoming harsh winter conditions and the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. The KRG's policy is that the return of IDPs to their places of origin has to be by choice. In a meeting with the UN envoy, President Nechirvan Barzani stated that the KRG supports a voluntary return of IDPs that are currently living in the Kurdistan region. On another front, Hossein Qaidi, the director of the Office of Rescue and Kidnap Yazidis for the Kurdistan Regional Government, has been named the recipient of the Sergio Vieira de Mello Prize, which is an annual award in Poland to individuals and organizations that promote human rights and dialogue. Qaidi is a Yazidi born in the Duhok province of Iraqi Kurdistan. After ISIS overran Sinjar, the Yazidi homeland, in 2014, he organized campaigns to find missing people, free them, and help them return to a normal life. According to official data, the KRG's Yazidi Rescue Office has saved over 3,537 Yazidis. That's out of the 6,417 that were kidnapped by ISIS, and about 2,880 remain missing. Turning to the KRG activities in the U.S., earlier this month, the Kurdish community, including the KRG staff and representative, bid farewell to Dr. Necmettin Kerim, the former governor of Kirkuk who died in his Maryland home in October. Dr. Kerim was a well-known Kurdish rights advocate in Washington, D.C., as well as a leading figure in Kurdistan. He was buried in Erbil, according to his last wishes. Also this month, Representative Abdurrahman made a virtual presentation to members of the World Affairs Council of Western Massachusetts. She was invited to update its members on recent developments in Kurdistan. She also held virtual meetings with Matthew Zias of the U.S. Department of Energy, Simone Ledeen of the U.S. Department of Defense, as well as State Department officials, including Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, on his retirement as a special envoy for Syria engagement and the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. The KRG's relationship with the United States continues to thrive. This fact was demonstrated by a two-day conference on November 23rd and 24th, which was hosted by a U.S. Chamber of Commerce in collaborations with the KRG representation in the United States. The virtual event attracted more than 400 American companies, officials, and organizations, as well as an estimated 2.5 million viewers who watched the live stream online and live coverage on Redoubt TV. The conference was addressed by KRG Prime Minister Masoud Barzani, U.S. Deputy Energy Secretary Mark Menzies, and a host of KRG and American officials and business representatives. Finally, we have an exciting update on culture. This November, the spotlight is firmly on women. Women have traditionally played a significant role in Kurdish society, but more so in recent years. Earlier this month, Sara Omar, who is a Danish-Kurdish author, was awarded the Golden Laurel, Denmark's top literature prize. Sara is a women's rights advocate who has won multiple awards for her work, and she's a best-selling author. Another star this month is Rez Gerdi. She's a Kurdish lawyer and activist who won New Zealand's Global Impact Award for her work to help refugee youth gain access to quality education and her efforts for human rights advocacy. Rez was raised in New Zealand and obtained her master's degree in law at Harvard University. She's currently based in the Kurdistan region where she works as a lawyer on cases for the prosecution of the so-called Islamic State for their genocidal campaign against the Yazidis. Finally, Zahra Doğan, a Kurdish artist from Kurdistan of Turkey, won the inaugural Kara Roma Award in Turin, northern Italy. Zahra is an exiled Kurdish artist and journalist who spent 3 years in Turkish jail for her art. Her work will be displayed next month. And now, the interview with Kathy Carey, the U.S. Strategic Partnerships Advisor for MAG. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thanks so much for inviting us. I'm excited to be here doing the podcast with you.
It's a pleasure having you. To begin with, tell me a bit about MAG and its involvement in deep mining in the Kurdistan region and the rest of Iraq.
So MAG is an international NGO that works across 23 countries. And in simple terms, we find and destroy landmines, cluster munitions, and unexploded bombs in places affected by conflict. With regard to our work in Iraq, Iraq is one of only three countries in the world that is classified as having massive contamination from anti-personnel landmines. The other two are Cambodia and Afghanistan. Anti-personnel mines in the KRI are a fraction of the contamination in central and southern Iraq, but the mines left from the previous decades would still rank the KRI on its own among the world's top five most contaminated regions. So Mag has been working in the Kurdistan region consistently since 1992, clearing landmines and bombs across all of the governorates and educating the communities there about the dangers. Many of the minefields in the KRI have been there since the 1980s, which in effect means that that land has been inaccessible and unusable for almost 30 years. We have staff working for us in Kurdistan that have been working for us since the beginning, so they are with us nearly 30 years now. In 2015, MAG expanded our work out of the KRI into Nineveh Governorate, targeting some of the villages in the north that had been retaken from ISIS in the most recent conflict. The scale of the contamination we found there was something we hadn't really seen before. But simply, it was massive. I wonder, for the benefit of your listeners, if it might be useful for me to explain a little bit about the activities that MAG does.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Thanks. In simple terms, we do three things. We identify where dangerous items are, such as landmines and unexploded ordnance. We remove them where it's possible, and we educate people who live in the areas on the dangers of what can be found in their homes and fields. The survey and the clearance work that MAG does works in kind of two different ways. One is kind of an emergency response mechanism where you can call up and a team will come and look at something that you found in your community. And the second is a more systematic, wide-scale survey and clearance effort that clears larger minefields and larger task sites. We use both manual deminers, so people with detectors, mechanical assets, and mine detection dogs. And alongside all of this kind of survey and clearance work is a community liaison element where MAG staff work with the communities that we're serving to gather information from them on what are their priorities and what contamination they have seen, and providing them with education and informing them of what we know about contamination in their area. We also work with the government mine action authorities, so ICMA in the KRI and the Directorate of Mine Action in Baghdad, to plan and prioritize our tasking and our yearly plans. And in addition to all of these partnerships with communities and government authorities, the other important partnership for us is the governments that fund us. So this is the Kurdistan in America podcast. The people of the United States have been supporting MAG's work in Iraq for many, many years through the Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement within the Paul Mill Bureau of the State Department. So this ongoing support from the American people over so many years really allows us to be more effective in our work and to plan our work over the longer term.
Kind of answered part of my question. But from April 2003 till February 2005, I served as an advisor for both the Coalition Provisional Authority and Civil Affairs units in Iraq. And part of my job was with the Iraq Mine Action. I recall the then estimate to demine the Kurdistan region border areas was set to take over 70 years. And that's if the work didn't stop. How serious is the mining issue in the Kurdistan region?
So the Kurdistan region of Iraq suffers from a legacy explosive ordnance contamination from a number of different conflicts. At the end of 2018, the Iraqi Kurdistan Mine Action Agency, which is known as ICMA, recorded mine contamination of 181 square kilometers in the KRI. To put that into perspective, that the area of Washington, D.C. is 177 square kilometers. So that is the size of area that is contaminated in the KRI. Soleimani is the worst affected governorate with 99 square kilometres of land known to be contaminated with anti-personnel landmines. For all of Iraq, that figure is 1,000 square kilometres. So only 20% or a fifth of the land is in the KRI. And none of that includes the massive amounts of contamination that have happened from the conflict with ISIS. So survey of these newer areas is still ongoing and still mostly unknown. In terms of your 70 year, in 2019, MAG released nearly 2 million square meters of land in the KRI and destroyed more than 1,000 landmines and more than 6,000 items of unexploded ordnance. And while those figures might seem like a lot, at that rate, it would take 90 years to clear the 181 square kilometres that ICMA have in their records. The calculations are oversimplistic because obviously other people are working as well as MAG, and it disregards a lot of the nuances of the work, but it still serves to illustrate the point, I think.
Wow. Now let's focus on your work in Sinjar. How's the mining situation there?
So MAG set up a base in Sununi in Sinjar in early 2016 with funding from the US government, actually. We'd already been working in other parts of northern Nunavut governorate since 2015. And as part of that work, Sinjar was identified as a priority because of the high levels of contamination, but also because of the desire of the people to return to their communities. As everyone has seen on the news, the people of Sinjar suffered terribly under ISIS, and reports of the atrocities that happened there are still coming out today. So MAG, along with the wider humanitarian community, recognised and understood that it was important to work to make sure that the people from the Sinjar area were supported to at least kind of start to rebuild their communities and their lives when they had already lost so much. In the places where MAG works, where possible, we recruit locally for most positions. So all of the demining and community liaison teams we recruited in the area were staffed with local people. Of course, there are always positions that can't be recruited and trained in relatively short periods of time, and you need to bring them in the beginning to fill the more senior roles. But we have been working consistently to build the capacity of all staff. Just as an indication of that, I think MAG in Iraq now has something like 750-ish staff, and maybe 30 of them total are international staff. So 720 of those people are people working within their own areas, clearing their own land. And at one point in the earlier days of working in around Sununi, I remember there was a joke that was said to us that was MAG was the biggest employer in the area. Once we had started working there. At the moment now, we still have 12 manual clearance teams, and we have mine detection dog teams and mechanical assets. So we employ about 220 people in Sinjar at the moment with the work that we're doing. Since the base opened and work began, MAG has released 4 square kilometres and removed more than 3,000 dangerous items. A lot of the work that we did from the beginning was north of Sinjar Mountain. And we've done most of the tasks that we have found there now. And our work is focused on the south of the mountain. But the problem is still enormous. As a bit of an example, the current task that we are looking at south of Sinjar Mountain covers 8 square kilometers and includes 6 villages. And there are just rows and rows and rows of improvised landmines and thousands of them laid in and around the land and villages there, and hundreds of houses that will need to be assessed before people can return. I think recently I heard a story that a Mukhtar from one of the villages had reported that he had 3 IEDs in his own house that he wanted us to come and clear. And what we've noticed in the past kind of 6 months or so in Sinjar and in other places is that there's been an increase in people returning home to their villages because of the fear of COVID-19 being spread in the camps that they were living in Duhok and other places. So we've really been trying to reach out to the people as they are returning to provide them with information and education materials as they come back. But the problem is still enormous.
So are these mines result of the recent conflict with ISIS, or is it from previous conflicts as well?
All of them, or the vast majority of what we are finding, are from the most recent conflict with ISIS. I call them landmines because of how they function, but most of them are homemade. So it's a pressure plate and a large pot or metal box that's filled with kind of a nitrogen-based explosive, but it will go off if it will be triggered by somebody standing on it, which is kind of what makes it an anti-personnel landmine. But they're not factory made. They are improvised and made by ISIS themselves.
My next question also regards Sinjar. And as you know, Sinjar is in a precarious situation. It's identified as one of the disputed areas in the Iraqi constitution. But its fate has been contentiously debated by both the KRG and Baghdad. And some of the Yazidi groups have their own views on the issue. And some have been exploited by some of the militia groups. Therefore, it is truly a hotly contested area. Fortunately, a historic agreement for normalizing the situation in Sinjar was reached between Baghdad and the KRG in early October. What's your take on that?
Well, as a non-governmental organization, MAG does not take positions on the political situation in countries where we work for the most part. However, I definitely welcome efforts by the government of Iraq and the Kurdistan Regional Government to come together to address the ongoing challenges regarding the political and security situation in Sinjar. I very much hope that the October agreement will enable the safe and voluntary return of the people of Sinjar who have not yet been able to come back, and will support the ongoing stabilization and reconstruction efforts there.
Great. Now let's talk about Into the Fire, the documentary about the work that MAG does in Sinjar. The film is a story of Hana, a married Yazidi mother of three, and her team's work. The story depicts the impact that ISIS had on their lives and the wider Yazidi community. Tell me about the story and what was the inspiration to make the documentary?
Thanks very much. We're very proud of this movie. So Into the Fire was shot over a period of only 1 week, actually, during the summer of 2018. And it was directed by a man called Orlando von Eisendel for a British company named Grain Media. It was part of a series of documentaries developed by the National Geographic in association with the Nobel Prize. The director, von Eisendel, is maybe best known for directing the White Helmets documentary made about Syria, which was nominated for an Oscar there a few years ago. The film itself follows Hannah Kadir and her and a team of female deminers working in Sinjar district as they go about their daily lives and their work with MAG. Hannah's only 28, but she's worked for MAG for almost 4 years now. And in the film, she leads a dedicated and I guess highly skilled team of staff working to clear mines in their own communities. The film focuses on her team's work, but also looks at Hannah's family life and the impact that ISIS has had on their lives and the wider Yazidi community. As I presume your listeners probably already know, the Yazidis are a minority religious group who suffered enormously at the hands of ISIS. And thousands of people were murdered and thousands of women and young girls were abducted and raped. While occupying their land, ISIS also then planted hundreds of thousands of deadly landmines and other devices throughout the area that prevented the resumption of their normal lives, even after ISIS had been removed from the area. I think, personally, like the most striking thing about the film when you watch it is the strength and the resilience of Hannah and her colleagues. The teams of female deminers recruited by MAG and Sinjar were the first female deminers that MAG was ever able to recruit in Iraq. Over our, at the time, 25 odd years. When MAG advertised for staff to work for us in Sinjar, they just came forward and applied and put their hands up. And I think Hannah and her colleagues illustrate the capacity of women to do work that in many cultures would be considered to be men's work. And they really are fighting back against the atrocities committed against their communities by ISIS. Now MAG has also recruited female deminers in other parts of Nineveh, and other organizations working in Iraq have also recruited female technical staff, but it was all started with those teams in Sinjar. In terms of why the film was made, I won't pretend to speak for Orlando, the director, but from interviews I've seen with him, it seems that what really struck him was that while the story of the atrocities that were perpetrated against the Yazidi community were very widely documented in the media, there wasn't really any coverage, or very much at all, of their efforts to rebuild their communities afterwards. The director has explained that it was this message of rebuilding and the hope for the future that inspired him to make the movie. And for your listeners, if they're interested to see the film, you can find a link to it on the MAG website, maginternational.org, if they'd like to watch it. It's only 25 minutes.
Thanks for sharing it. Okay, my next question is about your experience. Do you have a particular story from your time in Kurdistan or the rest of Iraq that you think best shows the importance of the work MAG has done?
I think I have two. And I guess for context, I lived in Erbil from 2015 until 2018. Working for MAG. And out of that time, I think the story that has stayed with me the most was of a day when we visited a particular town in Nineveh Governorate. The name is, I won't mention the name of it actually, but there were so many devastated and damaged and destroyed towns that we had visited and we had worked in, but this one was the worst that I had seen. And I think at the time, maybe even the worst that some of my technical colleagues had seen. The town itself was cordoned off so that people couldn't enter it because there were explosives in so many of the buildings and kind of tripwires across a lot of the streets that would detonate explosives if you stepped on them. So the town was effectively closed. There were no people living in this village when we were there, but there were a number of families living in the outskirts of the village. And one particular family we visited. And that family had come back to that house once ISIS had been pushed out, and they came back to try and rebuild their lives in that area. But unfortunately, in the area outside of their house, two of their children were killed while playing, and one of their other children, who was there when we were visiting, had been injured in the explosion. And that story really stayed with me. Like, that family had been through so much tragedy already. And now, when they thought the worst of it was over, had experienced probably the worst thing that most people can imagine. MAG cleared the land outside that family's house. But after the accident happened, but when we spoke to them, they were still very nervous about going outside. And the way I feel about it, no one should have to have that experience. And it really kind of brings home to me the importance of the work that we do. And I really think of this family regularly. War and conflict is a horror that has to be endured by kind of far too many innocent people. And I think the presence of landmines and UXO and cluster munitions and others means that even when the conflict has supposedly ended, the horror and the fear has to continue on for so long for these people. And that's a really disturbing thought. And the more you can work to prevent other families experiencing what that family experienced, I think it's incredibly important.
Absolutely. Security is the number one variable in having the Yazidi and the Christians to return to their areas.
Yeah, and I read a research report recently done by another NGO working with IDPs in some of the camps in Duhok, and it was, I think the figure was something like 70% of the people who were interviewed said, you know, that contamination in their homes and their land was one of the key reasons why they couldn't return to where they were from. And I think it's a very kind of poignant piece of information that, even all other things aside, if your house and your land is full of explosives, there's no way for you to go back.
Absolutely. Now, at the end of every interview, we ask our guests the same three questions. The first question is, when was the first time you heard about Kurdistan?
I come from a family, I think, where there are always newspapers and the news is always on in the house. So I think I probably have had a vague awareness of Kurdistan for quite a long time. I must admit, though, I definitely didn't really understand anything until I moved there in 2015. And I think even after spending 3 years living in Erbil, I hadn't even really scratched the surface by the time that I left.
And the second question, what is a word or phrase that sums up Kurdistan for you?
There are quite a few words that I could use, but I think that the one that strikes me the most from my time spent there is warm and warmth. I do mean the weather and the 50 degrees in August, but I don't only mean the weather. I mean the people. The people I came into contact with, either in the communities where we're working or indeed with the MAG staff family or the people in the local shops I went to, were always so incredibly friendly and caring and generous. And I just always loved the idea that at any given time, no matter where you were, if you were in a field or on the side of the road or in an IDP camp, didn't really matter. There was always the possibility that somebody would turn up and offer you a cup of tea. And I just, it stands to me as like my lasting memory of Kurdistan. Somebody always turned up with tea.
Kurdish hospitality. What is a word, our final question, what is a word or phrase that sums up America for you?
Well, I haven't managed to spend too much time living in America yet. But the word that always comes to mind to me is big, which sounds peculiar, but I am from Ireland, which is very small. And there are roughly the same number of people living in the DC metropolitan area as there are on the whole island of Ireland, north and south. And the idea of being able to get into a car and drive for days and days and days is so alien to me, being from a small place. But I also mean big, I think, in other ways. Like America is kind of the place of big ideas and big dreams and big hearts. And all of these things kind of strike me most, I think, when I think about time I've spent in the country and friends that I've made that are from the country. It's expansive.
Great analysis, and I agree. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure having you.